if I can have your attention. We will go ahead and get started with our program for this morning. On this beautiful, crisp fall afternoon, I want to welcome all of you to another meeting of the First Friday Breakfast Club, an association of gay and bisexual men, and the largest breakfast club in the state of Iowa. And we are a talkative group sometimes. In keeping with our tradition, I want to invite those who are here for the first time or someone's guest for the first time to introduce themselves or be introduced. And it's a painless process. Are there those who are here for the first time who would like to be introduced? Anyone?
I can do it. Okay. I am Cephas, and this is my first time.
Welcome. See how easy that was? Are there others? No?
I feel awesome.
Welcome. Others? Okay, well, I want to take just a moment because there is one other person that is not a familiar face here that I want to introduce and make a couple of comments about, and that is Brenda Pringle, my secretary, who is seated here in front of me. It feels a little like the Wizard of Oz, and the curtain is being pulled back, and this is not really me, this is Brenda Pringle. Who is the president of the First Friday Breakfast Club, just has done all of that without the recognition. Brenda Pringle has supported the Breakfast Club for 22 years. And this year she is retiring and moving to Wisconsin to be closer to her family up there. She has been my secretary for 34 years, which is a testimony to her patience. And I don't know what I'm going to do now that I have to start thinking for myself. Brenda, for these 22 years, has done all of the behind-the-scenes work. She generates the letters to our speakers when I line a speaker up. She generates the thank you letter that goes to our speakers when they have come and spoken. She generates the initial agenda for our annual meeting and for all of our monthly board meetings. She has done filing. She has taken lists home of names and addresses and on her own time proofread that, and always catches things that we have missed. She has come in and said, "Didn't this person die last year? We probably ought to take them off the list." She has been a phenomenal support for our Breakfast Club, and we would not have had the success that we have had but for this unsung hero of the Breakfast Club. And so the bad news is that she is retiring, and that has implications for the Breakfast Club and for my law practice as well. The good news is that we have bought her a computer, and she has agreed to continue supporting the Breakfast Club going forward, as she has in the past. We were talking at the board meeting about this fact that she was retiring, and it occurred to a number of us that there were only a couple of people on the board of directors that had ever met Brenda. But many of them had interactions with Brenda and worked with Brenda over the phone and electronically. Well, there's electronics and phones in Wisconsin, believe it or not. So we've tracked her down. We've bought her a computer. She is going to be supporting the Breakfast Club going forward in every way that she can. She said she was going to be otherwise bored to tears And with tears in her eyes, she said she would be pleased to continue supporting the Breakfast Club. So that's the good news, and I want to acknowledge you and thank you, thank you, thank you. Recognition. If many of you would thank her individually after the meeting, I would appreciate it. A number of other announcements. First, our book exchange is back here on this piano in the corner. Thanks to Scott Kuchnew, my partner, for coordinating that. You're welcome to borrow books, and there's no checkout system, and if you have books that you'd like to share with others, just bring them and we'll work them into the collection. I invite you to go to the FFBC website, ffbciowa.org. There you can get copies of our archived newsletters. You can also hear our speakers. We audio record their remarks and their Q&A responses. And so if you want to hear it again or you miss a meeting and want to hear one of the speakers, that opportunity is available on our website. There's also an opportunity with a sheet that's on the registration table. If you look around the room and you see that there is someone missing that you think would be interested in this Breakfast Club, get us the name and we will make sure to extend them a personal invitation, encourage them to come to the Breakfast Club. Another announcement or two today at 5 o'clock at the home of John Schmaker, there is going to be a meet and greet for gubernatorial candidate Nate Bolton. That's at 3724 Hunter. So if you would like to meet him, you have that opportunity. I think it is also a fundraiser, but I don't think it's required. But if you want to meet him, by the time the evening is over, you may decide you want to contribute to his campaign. Next, also today at 5:30 until 7 at Gilroy's, that's located at 1238 8th Street in West Des Moines. There's going to be a Senior Summit reception. It is free of charge, and there will be drink and refreshments provided. It's being sponsored by AARP. So if there are those of you who are planning to go to the summit tomorrow, or you just would like to go to a free reception and get some beverages and refreshments, that's your opportunity at Gilroy's from 5:30 to 7. Tomorrow, then, is the Senior Summit, 8:30 until 2:30. I think the charge is $30, and it is going to be held at Grandview University Student Center, for those of you who might be interested, or who have been there before, and because you're senior, you're getting forgetful and can't remember what time or where. So it's tomorrow, 8:30, Grandview University Student Center. Next, our board meeting is next Wednesday, the 9th, 6:15 at Scott's in my home on the south side. If there are members who would like to attend a board meeting, you're certainly welcome. Touch base with either of us and give you easy to follow directions. The newsletter copy for the next issue is going to be next Monday, the 7th. So for those of you who are regular contributors to the newsletter, there's your deadline. If there are others of you who would like to write to the newsletter, just get your copy to me and we will get it in shape to make you look really good when it's published in the newsletter. If you have any subject matter that is of interest to you, it's probably going to be of interest to other people in our group. Also, you can look forward to this particular issue. There's going to be an article by Jonathan Page, who used to be the minister of the church in Ames, is now in Houston, and it's an article on the transgender issue as it is coming before the Texas legislature to try and decide who can use what bathroom. You'd think they have more important things to worry about, but not. Next, prime timers. There are cocktails at Lime Lounge on the 9th. There's a potluck social on the 11th. There's a breakfast at Cubs Club on the 14th. There's a Broadview Gardens tour on the 19th. There's a movie night on the 24th. And that's just some of the activities that Primetimers is planning for the month of August. There is a brochure on each of the tables that gives you some information about how to contact Primetimers and get involved with Primetimers, and I encourage you to do that. And then save the date on September the 2nd. There's going to be a prose party, and that's going to also be at John Schmaker's home from 7 until 10 o'clock. Thank you very much, John.
And that will be another whole weeding that I will have to do. Yeah,
but he does great weeding, and his yard looks wonderful. All right, and with that, I will turn to Friedhelm Brinkhaus, who is going to introduce our speaker this morning. Friedhelm.
Good morning, everybody. Ryan Burke is a writer, activist, and program manager for the Connect Host Home Program of Avenues for Homeless Youth. His debut book, No House to Call My Home, Love, Family, and Other Transgressions, won the 2016 Minnesota Book Award for General Nonfiction, the 2016 NCCD Media for a Just Society Award, and was listed as a top 10 LGBTQ book of 2016 by the American Library Association. Burke received the New York Foundation of the Arts Fellowship in Nonfiction Literature and was a Lambda Literary Foundation Emerging Writers Fellow. His work has appeared in Plowshares, Slate, The Chronicle for Social Change, The Advocate, Salon, Local Knowledge, The Rumpus, and The Sun. Burke has been awarded residencies from the McDowell Colony, Yaddo, and Virginia Center for the Creative Arts. For his youth work, he has received the True Community Award from the True Colors Fund and the Lavender Community Award from Lavender Magazine. He lives in Minneapolis. Please welcome Ryan.
Good morning, y'all.
Good morning.
This is early for me, just so you know. I think the earliest event I've done before this was 9 a.m., so this trumps it. Trumps it by an hour and a half or so. Oh, yeah, thank you. We need to find a new adjective. I live in Minneapolis. I'm from Des Moines originally. I grew up in West Des Moines, went to Valley. And when I came back to the Midwest, I lived in New York for a number of years, and when I came back to the Midwest, Ryan Crane invited me to this meeting. So it's really nice to kind of come back and be able to present here. Before we got started today, I was talking to Jonathan a little bit, and when I was, 19, is when Jonathan was often in the newspaper, and my boyfriend and I just had come out, my boyfriend and I decided to go show our support, and we went to a meeting down the street. When there was some back and forth in the community around whether to support Jonathan or not. And it was the first time in my life where the vitriol and hatred in the room really kind of made me fear for my life. I was kind of living obliviously, I think, to that point around the level of hatred within the community for folks who identify as LGBTQ. So that meeting and the strength that Jonathan had exhibited really became one of the igniters in my work in becoming an advocate for LGBTQ youth. So I just wanted to publicly thank Jonathan for all he's done for this community. So I work in Minneapolis now. I work for Avenues for Homeless Youth, which is a program that provides housing for youth 16 to 21. The program I run is called Connect, which works with LGBT youth specifically. And we provide resources and support for young folks. It's a community-based organization. We partner with folks in the community. They provide food and shelter, and we provide wraparound services and support. It's a community-based initiative. It wouldn't exist without community involvement. And I think that's a really important thing. I started this work, youth work, in 2004 in New York City, And what I've witnessed is that systems-based work, a prescriptive one-size-fits-all, doesn't work for all youth. So community involvement, especially when we're talking about LGBTQ youth, is essential and important. So I'm going to read a little bit from my book, which is available in the back for free. So if you want a copy, I just brought some, donated some copies to bring to the meeting today. So if you're interested, please take one. So I'm going to read to give a little context about what the issue is pertaining to LGBTQ youth experiencing homelessness, the pipeline from foster care into homelessness. I'm going to give a little example from a story, anecdotal story in the book. And then I'm going to talk about the work I'm doing in Minneapolis briefly and show a really short video. And then if you have any questions about how folks in Des Moines can become involved in providing supports for queer and trans youth who are experiencing homelessness, I'm happy to talk to you about that. So let's get started. There are more than 400,000 youth in the United States foster care system today, roughly the same number as the population of Sacramento, California. Foster care, created to protect the welfare of children, is a broken system, hobbled by outdated bureaucracy, underfunded agencies, and overburdened workers that frequently produces dire outcomes, which I know you all experienced here recently in Iowa. Research shows that children placed in foster care are more likely than veterans of war to develop post-traumatic stress disorder. In some states, youth are just as likely to be abused in foster care as they are in the homes from which they were removed. Foster care has become a gateway into homelessness. Nearly half of the youth experiencing homelessness today have had at least one placement within a foster home or a group home. LGBTQ youth in particular face significant prejudice and discrimination in foster care. Many queer-identified young people who are disproportionately represented in the system report intolerance, physical and emotional mistreatment, neglect, and abuse by caregivers or peers. LGBTQ youth are more likely than their heterosexual counterparts to be placed in group homes. An overwhelming majority of those youth in group homes have been victims to violence. The Opening Doors Project, which is a project that provides resources and support for legal and child welfare communities, highlights the following statistics. 70% of LGBTQ youth in group homes reported violence based on their LGBTQ status. 100% reported verbal harassment, and 78% of those youth were removed or ran away from placement because of hostility towards their identity. These pervasive and negative experiences have had a significant impact on mental health and emotional growth. Until recent years, child welfare agencies have neglected to provide accurate policy, best practices training, and guidance for workers or foster parents serving LGBTQ youth. Without cultural competency training around queer and trans issues, the result has been re-traumatization, continued abuse, and prolonged rejection for many young folks. The traumas in life in foster care are compounded for LGBTQ youth of color, many of whom struggle to reconcile their racial and sexual identities. As they age out of a system, a term that's used to describe a youth's departure from a formal system of care because of age limits, they are faced with an indifferent world. Across the country, inequities in housing, health, educational achievement, and rates of incarceration are staggering. Transgender women in particular are at a particularly high risk of homelessness. The rate of suicidal ideation among transgender and gender nonconforming people of color doubled from those encountering family rejection, as did rates of sex work, rates of homelessness also tripled. These problems will persist until we wake up locally, nationally, and morally, and give a hard, steady look at what is causing these issues, and then take action to address them. In early 2004, I began working as a residential counselor and then subsequently as a caseworker for LGBTQ youth in the foster care program in New York City. The program was made up of two group homes, what I call the 401, located in Queens, and Keep Street in Brooklyn. For me, doing this work was a way to re-engage with the world, to give something back. I started as a residential counselor, an entry-level position requiring a high school diploma and a clean record. The job responsibilities included providing on-site direct care for youth in the group home, prompting them to do chores like cooking and cleaning, helping manage conflicts, and engaging them with healthy activities. As a caseworker, I was tasked with goal setting, coordinating services, and monitoring the progress of the young person in the program. The aim is to reunify them with family or to provide the tools to live independently. I found myself wholly unprepared for the myriad of personal and social issues I was forced to confront. Thrown headfirst into the work, I found my understanding of racial and economic justice, gender identity, crime, and poverty were challenged at every turn. Facing the realities of the youth on a daily basis deepened my understanding of privilege, social responsibility, and community, and ultimately altered my understanding of myself. While doing this work, I learned the statistics. The data point to a litany of troubling risk behaviors. Queer and trans youth are more likely to use and abuse substances. They experience sexual abuse, violence, and clinical depression at greater rates than the general population. Research indicates that LGBTQ youth are more than twice as likely to attempt suicide as their straight peers. Now, risk-taking is typical in adolescence, but you couple that with isolation and the rejection that many queer and trans youth face, and self-destruction becomes the modus operandi. Leaning on unhealthy ways to cope with trauma can become habitual, and youth with self-destructive tendencies are more likely to become adults with self-destructive addictions. In trying to show the youth alternatives to sex work, attempting to break their cycles of drug and alcohol use, and help them build their self-esteem, I was reminded of my own litany of risk behaviors, my own struggle as a young man grappling with identity, and my own tendency to seek solace in drugs, alcohol, and sex in order to mask the pain felt by microaggressions and internalized homophobia. While the LGBTQ movement has made incredible strides in recent years, the neglect of LGBTQ youth issues is astounding. When 40% of all youth identifying as homeless identify as LGBTQ, but make up only 8% of the population, it's clear that the greatest struggles within our own community are not all oriented around marriage. Audre Lorde taught us that there's no such thing as a single issue struggle. Audre Lorde taught us that there's no such thing as a single issue struggle because we do not live single issue lives. LGBTQ youth struggles are intrinsically tied to healthcare, housing, public safety, prison, immigration, employment, and housing. The stories in this book are my effort for readers to have a glimpse into an often unseen world, to evoke change in the lives of youth left without a home because of systemic failures, abuse, neglect, or intolerance because of their sexual orientation or gender identity. Facing the realities of these young folks daily forced me to recognize how our own systems fail our most vulnerable and how much more needs to be done to provide support. The challenges I witnessed these youth confront would send most adults into a mental collapse, yet they soldiered on, imbued with a belief that a better life was out there, no matter how bleak their lives had been. I'm going to introduce you to a young woman named Barbara, who I worked with in New York for a while. And then I'll share a little video about what I'm doing in Minneapolis. I'm surprised when Barbara walks into my office, sits down, and acts like nothing's new. She's been AWOL from the group home for a month now. I think she's living with her girlfriend's family, but there's no way to be sure. Things were going well until her father and stepmother showed up at the court for her permanency planning hearing, where the judge must determine the appropriateness of the agency's long-term plan for that youth and the reasonableness of the agency's efforts to execute that plan. Before entering the courtroom, they cornered Barbara, berated her, and disowned her for acting like a boy. If she put on a dress, he'd consider supporting her, her father said, but as she is, she's an abomination. I tried to separate them, to shield Barbara from his words, but by the time we were ushered in to see the judge, she was trembling. I was there to tell the court that Barbara had improved since coming into the program. She was placed with the agency after her stepmother filed a person in need of supervision PINS petition, a request for the court to intervene when a child becomes out of control. Barbara's stepmother said that she was wild and disrespectful. She'd leave the house for days at a time and was truant from school. The stepmother alleged physical threats and drug abuse. Barbara claims her stepmother just wanted her out of their lives. Her father was given an ultimatum, and he chose his wife. When Barbara came into our care in mid-2004, she began attending school regularly for the first time in nearly 2 years. Her teacher said that she was smart and that she participated in class. She hadn't run away from the group home or stayed out past curfew like she did while living with her father. She never tried to hide her marijuana use, and the agency was working with her on issues of chemical dependency. On the day of the planning hearing, her father got her so worked up outside of the courtroom that when the judge addressed her, she snapped at him. "You see how she acts, Your Honor?" her father said. Crying, she cursed at him and had to be escorted out. When we left court that day, her placement with the agency was extended for another 6 months. Barbara was silent on the train ride home and studied the advertisements for facial citrus peels in order to avoid conversation. Her face didn't betray any emotion. I told her to forget what her father had said. She was making strides and needed to continue in that direction. The subway car rattled and shook. The lights flickered as we screeched to a halt at her station. "Stay strong," I said to her. "I'm here for you." She smiled dimly and promised she'd continue to try hard, then turned to exit the subway car. She went AWOL that night from Keep Street and stopped attending school. She calls occasionally to tell me she's okay, but never discloses her location. I hadn't seen her since that day in court, nearly a month ago. Barbara absently punches the keyboard of my computer with one finger. Pinned up on the wall behind her, along with a list of caseworker telephone extensions and GED test locations, is a large photograph of Barbara standing with her father and her brother at the zoo. In the picture, there's a youthful innocence about her. That joy, that free expression on her face, is missing from the person that I know. Barbara pulls her camouflage Yankees cap down on her face. She looks frail, like she stopped eating. The sports jersey she wears hangs from her slight frame. She swims in her jeans. Her dark skin is ashen, and her eyes look heavy and somber. I don't know how long I'll have her here, so I pull out my wallet, drop a 20 into her hand, and tell her to use it for food. She thanks me, smiles, then her eyes fall to her sneakers. When I ask how she's doing, she becomes motionless, seems to be holding her breath. She has a sweet disposition. Normally she's good-natured, but out of nowhere she can erupt, lashing out at the tiniest transgression. But that's a side we didn't see much. Typically, when still at the group home, she would be found watching BET with the other residents, her bright smile exposing a line of perfect white teeth. When Barbara arrived at Keep Street, the staff loved her right away. Gladys gushed about her acclimating to the home. She made her bed in the morning and left out for school right on time. This child does her chores and don't need to be told twice about curfew. "How the hell did you find us this one?" Gladys said with a sharp laugh. The honeymoon period ended when Barbara flew into a rage at Dia, another resident whom she accused of stealing her Nike Air Jordans. Gladys said it was impossible to de-escalate Barbara's behavior, that it took three counselors to defuse the situation. When Gladys tried to intervene, Barbara bristled and told her to go back to her box of cookies in the office and mind her business. She persisted, and Barbara grabbed a candy bar off the counter, dangled it in front of Gladys like bait, calling her a hippo. She was unfazed by Barbara's outburst. Most of the residents were prone to lashing out. Later, Barbara went to Gladys in her office and apologized, said she didn't know what had happened, didn't know what made her so angry. Barbara is AG, or an aggressive, a label used in the gay urban community for butch lesbians. She binds her breasts, dresses in baggy jeans and sports jerseys. Her hair is set in tight cornrows. On the street, she's always assumed to be a boy. She has a tough, callous veneer, or at least she used to. She hides her hurt, and now she can't hide her hurt anymore. "I don't know what to do. I can't do it no more," she says with an exhale and begins to tremble. She makes her hands into fists, then opens them. The 20 drops to her feet. "I can't do it." Her eyes roll towards the ceiling and her body tenses. She flinches so fully that I think for a moment she's having a seizure. Then tears begin to fall. "I got nobody," she says. "I wish my office had a door to shut to give us some privacy." "Come back to the house," I say, and roll my chair closer to her, leaning in. "We can make this work." Her face becomes taut until she releases into sobs and her shoulders heave. She no longer hears me. She's alone, deep inside some place within herself. "Why you leave?" "Leave?" I say. "Barbara, I never..." She lets out a wail that shakes me. "Grandma," she calls out. Her head bows. She wipes her wet nose with the ball of her hand. "She's the only one who loved me." I place my hand on her shoulder and feel how her body trembles. I search for some Kleenex to give her, but only find balled up tissue with chewed up bubble gum in the center. I don't have any words that seem appropriate. I know there's nothing I can say to protect her. I'm helpless to provide even a glimmer of hope. "Come back" is all I can say, and we both know that's not enough. I pick the 20 off the floor and push it back into Barbara's hand. Her cheeks are wet. Her breathing stutters. I try to strategize the way a caseworker should. Barbara's safety is paramount and her needs are immediate, but she refuses to return to the group home, saying that it's too chaotic, that she can't put up with the other residents lying and stealing. I could initiate an emergency respite placement at a different group home outside the LGBTQ program, but I know Barbara won't go. She's stubborn, willing to consider only one option. She wants to be transferred to our apartment program, where residents pair up with one roommate. I've told her time and time again that that program is designed for youth who have shown potential to live independently. The rules are clear. All residents considered for the apartment program must be functioning well in the group home, do their chores regularly, and follow regulations. They must demonstrate good relationships with other residents, attend school on a regular basis, and have a part-time job. Barbara currently fails to meet any of the criteria. I plead with her again to return to Keep Street. I'll call her school and see if they'll take her back between classes and a part-time job. She'll rarely have to see the other residents, limiting any chance of any conflict that may arise. She could be eligible for the apartment program within a few months. Then who's going to watch my stuff when I'm gone? The staff? Her face sours. The minute I leave the house, you know they're going to jack all my shit. I know she's right. Even though all the residents have their own cabinets and padlocks to store their belongings, the moment one is left unattended, it's broken into. The locks are pried open, the wooden slats of the cabinets are split, and the residents' sneakers, shirts, and caps are swiped and sold on the street. Stealing has become an epidemic in the house. Each time a resident begins to accumulate a wardrobe, the necessary accoutrements of adolescence, everything is stolen. I tell her to come back to the house. No, Barbara says. No way I'm going back there. When I ask if she can stay with her brother, she shakes her head. He's just turned 18 and can't take on the responsibility of his younger sister. I don't even suggest her father as an option. After the court date, he was impossible to talk with. He continued the name-calling, the blaming. When I tried to follow up after our meeting, I was met with icy derision. Barbara was my problem, I was told. They were done with her. Even youth who function well within foster care are likely to flounder once they're out on their own. After aging out of the system, over half of the youth remain unemployed. Debilitating depression, anxiety, and addiction affects one-third of this population. Unless there's a visiting resource, an adult who can function as a role model, a stable, caring presence in their lives, there's little hope for a life outside of the streets or outside of the system. What about Rochelle, I ask. Barbara's been living with her girlfriend's family off and on since leaving Keep Street. Rochelle is two years older than Barbara and is 7 months pregnant. According to Jessica, my boss, the family's house is on the verge of collapse. Rochelle's mother has 10 children, all of whom still live with her. She collects Social Security checks, and other than her older children selling drugs, there's no money for the family. When Barbara's there, she's just another mouth to feed, which causes tension between Rochelle and her brothers. Barbara wants to get a job and to help buy groceries, but because she's only 16 and isn't attending school, she doesn't have any working papers. No one will hire her for any legal work. She told me on the phone that around the time that she went AWOL, that all she wanted to do was raise Rochelle's baby with her to give that baby a happy life. Rochelle don't want me there no more, she tells me now, and fuck her anyway. I can tell by Barbara's leaden, lifeless eyes that she's had enough. She's tired of searching for places to stay, of fighting with Rochelle and her brothers. I'm afraid she'll have to resort to survival sex or drug running in order to feed herself. I pull out a piece of paper and tell her to write down every person she knows. Maybe there's a family member she hasn't thought of for a while, some distant relative. She holds the pen just above the surface of the paper, drawing circles in the air. She does this for a while longer, then drops the pen to the desk. Ain't nobody, she says, and rises from her seat. I stand with her and lean against the door. I'm not ready for her to leave. I know that when she walks out of my office, she'll have no place to go. I don't think we're done here, I say, but she's had enough and pushes past me, down the corridor, vanishing into the staircase. For the first time since meeting her, I fear I'll never see Barbara again. Streetlights seep into my apartment window. The lamp on the nightstand shines from underneath, casting steep shadows against my wall. I pull out a bottle of Hornitos tequila and a pack of Parliament lights out of a brown paper bag. On my way home from the office, I knew I'd want something to burn the day away. I take a shot just as the phone rings. Too drained to talk to anyone, I just sit. After the fourth ring, my answering machine clicks on. Ryan, it's Gladys. I stand up and walk over to the voice. Somebody stopped by the house and wanted to talk to you. Hi, Ryan. The voice is quiet, childlike. It's Barbara. I lean down and turn up the volume. I just wanted to say thanks for today, and I wanted to tell you I thought of somebody. I got a cousin down south that I want to try and live with. When I hear the receiver hang up, I move back to my bed and sit down. The silence in my empty room rings in my ears. I reach for the bottle and think of Barbara's prospects. I take a swig of tequila, and it goes down like warm ribbons of amber. Thinking of Barbara's future, I want to feel something like relief, but can't. Thanks. So Barbara's doing really well now. I like to leave on a little happier note than that. She ended up moving upstate New York, found her community, and found relationships that were sustainable and supported her, which makes all the difference in the world. I mentioned a few times in the book, caring, consistent adults can make a huge impact and difference on the stability a young person experiences in their lives. So she's doing really well and has found that community for herself. So I think one thing that the book highlights is prescriptive one-size-fits-all models oftentimes don't work for young folks, right? Like it didn't for Barbara. She wanted the apartment program, but there were all this the criteria that was in front of her that she couldn't meet. So a model that we use now in working with youth experiencing homelessness is called Housing First, right? So it's the idea that you get someone housed and stable, and then you start to work on some of the issues that they may be needing to address, like mental health issues or substance use issues. So the program I work with in Minneapolis at Avenues for Homeless Youth is called the Host Home Model, which is a community-based response to homelessness. So it's not systems-based. We don't license our homes. We don't receive any government funds, and that's on purpose. So we can address the needs of youth in the moment as they arise. And we recognize that community has to step up and do something about what's going on within our own communities, right? So the queer and trans youth in our community, the numbers that are national, 40% of all youth experiencing homelessness identify as queer and trans. That's represented in Minneapolis and St. Paul. Obviously, community needs to do more. In Minnesota, there are 6,000 young people experiencing homelessness on any given night. We have 700 beds for those young people that are youth-specific. So obviously, there's a huge gap, and folks have to do more to provide support. I'm going to show a short video about what I'm doing now, and then I'll take questions if there are any. All right, thanks.
With them and get a feel for them. before I was expected, just living with these strangers. And you feel more like a person involved in your own life than a peg looking to be put into a slot.
At some point it became so clear that we are this stable couple and we love each other and that we have space in our home, and why wouldn't we? So it became, how could we not, instead of how could we?
We had resources that we could share
and space,
which is, what they need.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
The goal of the Joint Teaching Program is that for this amount of time, the young person didn't have to worry about food and shelter. So that's the beautiful thing about the JLT Wilson program. That's the goal. What happens during that time, that's the icing on the cake.
I want to go to school. I want to get a job. I want to open a bank account. Then we sit down and we're like, okay, I asked them, I was like, okay, so you want these three things. How do you want to get them? Like, what are the steps that I'm going to take to get those things? And we start developing those kind of skills around, like, specifics on what is it that I need to do in order to get what it is that I want.
I feel like the program and the way Rocky speaks about the program, it isn't after solidarity.
Yeah.
It's saying this is a problem in our community and we need to act to solve it.
Mm-hmm. To see them, like, living, like, out and open and, like, being comfortable and okay with that, that was definitely a positive thing for me.
Because we're community-based, we're very much a part of the community. This program wouldn't exist without community involvement. So community buy-in to Host on Loop is essential. And I think, when we think about transformation, Host on Loop is not only transformational for the young people and hosts, but also community by extension. So it's about communities recognizing that there is a need and standing up and doing something about it. So working together in the community to make that happen.
The majority of homeless youth in this country, queer or not, are youth of color. So race and racism, white supremacy, white privilege are at the heart of their homelessness.
I went from that to not only being on firm footing, but being in a village, feeling like I was in a village of supportive, involved people who I could actually be involved with and support as well.
Thank you so much for spending time with me this morning and listening. I really do appreciate it. If anyone has questions, feel free to throw them out my way. Yes?
How do you think we could reform or improve the foster program?
That's a question for Matt McCoy, the front.
You are at the front line,
right.
So you have some idea.
Workers are overextended and not supported, and oftentimes, it's about warehousing young people and not providing the necessary relationship and support that's needed in order to build sustainable relationships that would help move young people into stability. So the work that I do now, I worked in the systems before, and to me it was too broken, and I didn't feel like I was managing levels of dysfunction, and that was basically all I was capable of doing within that structure. And that's why I now work within communities, right? So I feel like even though our programs are quite small, they're quite effective because it's about relationship and it's about building trust and support that go beyond the confines of...
So do you think foster families are part of the problem or the solution?
I think it's a both and. I don't think it's an either or situation. I think foster families can be part of the solution. They need to be supported. There needs to be checks and balances in place that are beyond what's... So, it's verbalized that there are checks and balances in place, but in action, it looks very different, right? In New York, I used to have to go and do home visits in families where it was very clear that it was a warehousing situation where young people were being housed in order for the host to have some, or the foster parents to have some money in the pocket. That's very common. You talk to any youth who've been through the system, and they'll say as much, that they were not able to eat the same food, that the the bio children were able to have, that they were locked out of certain rooms. All kinds of abuse happens on a daily basis. So, but if it's not, so for a lot of workers, a lot of that will be a kind of a hunch that you get a, you kind of take an assessment of the room. But if there isn't kind of factual material that you can't, if there's nothing you can report back, then it's just a hunch, and then you have to kind of keep returning to that home to ensure safety for the young person. And with when you have overburdened workers who have 80 cases on their caseload, that becomes an impossibility, right? So I think the system itself needs to be completely restructured personally. How that looks, I don't know. I mean, as a direct care person, I would love to work with policy folks and researchers on what that could look like. But I think I have a micro lens, and I think it requires a macro-micro lens. Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
Just wanted to say thank you for your book. I've used it a lot.
Great.
Especially as we dealt with this foster situation in Iowa. And one of the things that I've been trying to institute in Iowa is trying to get a sense of foster parents' feelings on LGBTQ youth before we do a placement, because we're currently not asking prospective foster parents or adoptive parents how they feel about LGBTQ kids coming into their homes. One of the things that I think happens is there's a huge disconnect, and if they end up in a home of somebody who's religiously or philosophically at odds with LGBTQ issues, then this kid ends up getting the brunt of it and eventually ending up on the streets.
Right.
And so we have to do this in Iowa, but they don't want to touch this issue.
This needs to happen nationally, and there's no requirement, right? Nationally, there's no federal mandate that would require that. Best practices, training, cultural competency training for both workers and foster parents around LGBTQ issues should be essential in a parent when 40% of those youth are queer or trans identified. But you know, I think the issue is what you just spoke to, which is the vast majority of foster agencies get their pool of applicants from faith-based organizations.
Yes.
And they may not be in line or feel like they have, they're at odds with LGBT culture and identity. So how do we circumvent that? How do we bypass that? I don't know. I think what it requires is more folks being out there, youth workers to be advocates for that kind of cultural change and that shift to take place. But you're right. It should be a requirement. It should be a federal requirement as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. Yes?
Comment on the implications of a presidential tweet that targets trans individuals in our society.
Oh, God. Yeah, the potential danger that this administration is causing is, yeah, it's soul-crushing. I've noticed it with the young people that I work with, just the fear that they've experienced, the kind of the sense that the folks who are displaying that vitriol and hatred, the kind of, now that they've been given a kind of platform, I think it's caused some of our young folks to kind of shrink. I think the mental health issues that we're seeing are exacerbated as well. I know that within Iowa, right, isn't it right now the worst state in the country when it comes to mental health support and services? And that's only going to be exacerbated by this issue. Like I mentioned in the beginning of the book, young queer and trans folks are already dealing with heightened levels in risk behavior around mental health support and services. So I think that's where it comes to community members to really stand up and start advocating. Call folks like Matt. Get involved on the ground and provide that support. Get the voices out there. Because until policymakers start to hear that their constituents want social change, not much is going to happen. Yes. Yes, sir.
The Chris Freddie Burke, along with the Matthew Shepard Foundation, has provided scholarships for many LGBTQ people that, young people especially, that are actually making their way fairly well through the system, and we allow them more assistance.
That's great.
I'm curious your thoughts on the idea of if our club changed our paradigm and went with giving scholarships to people in these programs only for maybe community college beginnings, thinking that if we get them through community college, they could even go on to four-year colleges or so on. Is that a paradigm that would work, do you think?
That's a really interesting question. I think what I've seen with a lot of LGBTQ-specific nonprofits and groups, like PFUND, for example, where they're kind of shifting their mission to engage intersectionality of identities, right? So the most marginalized within our LGBTQ community, right? So providing maybe have a, I could see like a splinter program where maybe, you know, you reserve one or two of those scholarships for a young person who's experiencing more marginalization than the average LGBT youth. I think that makes sense. Yes, sir.
Has there been any attempts to involve like foster care programs with like PFLAG, you know, where you have parents who maybe have exhibited acceptance of their gay offspring and involve that with in servicing and foster care programs? I'm trying to think of how you take a family. You know, been accepting and nurturing of a gay child,
right,
and pair that with an education program for people who are not be as experienced in that area.
That's a really good question. So there's a lot of work that's being done right now around preventative aspects. So family strengthening work is what it's called. So identifying if a young person may be experiencing challenges in the home based off of their identity, and how then community support, therapists, case managers, social workers can come in and provide support to the family as well as the young person. So do some education work and preventative work with those families. It's kind of isolated right now, so because there is no mandate around best practices in LGBT cultural competency, you're finding just like it's peppered throughout, but it's not a standard that's being used. But that kind of work, I think partnering with PFLAG in the Twin Cities, we have Transforming Families, which is a trans-specific program that's similar to the PFLAG model, where it's parents and family members who have a trans person in their lives and providing supports and resources for them. So we partner with them quite a bit in the agency that I work with. And there's a group called Reclaim in the Twin Cities, which provides mental health support and services for LGBTQ youth specifically. So we do a lot of family strengthening work with them. But it's also, all of our programming is youth determined. So that means if the youth wants that work done, if they want to engage with the family, it might be too re-traumatizing for them at this juncture to make that happen. So I think on a case-by-case basis, it's really important to kind of analyze if that's would be a useful tool in the moment. But I think, you know, if I were to say kind of like a brushstroke, yes, I think that would be an incredibly important aspect to prevention. Yes, sir.
How is your program funded?
That's a really good question. So we get the vast majority of our funding from the United Way. And then in the Twin Cities, there's the Arise Project, which is kind of like a splinter program of the United Way, which is LGBTQ specific. And then it's foundations and private donors. We do a lot of fundraising. Yep. Anyone else? Thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Ryan. It's been a part of our tradition to give a token of appreciation to our speakers. It's a recording of the Des Moines Gay Men's Chorus.
Thank you so much.
You will enjoy.
Thanks, Jeff. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Ryan. You are involved at the very vortex of a current issue, and you deserve our support, and we certainly appreciate you coming, making this trip down here, coming home, and sharing with us the important work that you're doing up there. You are reminded that he has books in the back that you're welcome to help yourself to, and if you don't happen to get one this time, I'm just about finished with the book, and it will be going into our lending library as soon as I have finished it. It's a quick read, and it's well done, and I encourage you to check that out. I want to thank Ryan Wiedner for helping out with the technology this morning so that we could have that video. I want to introduce one additional guest who is here this morning. In the back here is my grandson, Calvin. I'm sure it's hard for you to believe that I'm old enough to have grandchildren. I actually have five of them, and I'm sure he would say that he's the favorite. At any rate, I also want to make one other comment directed to Brenda. I do some estate planning in my practice, and when I have people come in to sign their wills, we need witnesses and notaries and the like, and Brenda always helps out with that when someone executes their will. I executed a new will not very long ago, and Brenda wasn't permitted to help with witnessing or being the notary on that will execution because it's not best practice for a beneficiary to witness a will. Over the course of 22 years, I think there have probably been occasions where I've given you occasion to, or reason to wish I would drop dead. Now you have one more reason. Thank you again, Brent. Coming up in September, on the 1st, September is National Food Pantry Month, and Michelle Book, the CEO of Food Pantry of Iowa, is going to be our speaker. Then in October, our speaker will be Mark Stringer, the newly installed CEO of ACLU of Iowa. He's been the pastor at First Unitarian Church on the South Side. He has spoken to our Breakfast Club before. One of the most outstanding presentations that we have ever had, I think. So you will not want to miss in October when Mark Stringer, who has retired from that church and is going to the ACLU of Iowa, is going to be here to be our speaker. So we have all of that to look forward to, and I look forward to seeing all of you at a future meeting of FFBC. Thanks for being here today.